going to talk about... I hadn't quite taken in the title of the talk that was on the information about the day, but funnily enough, I've been struggling to come up with a title. I usually do the title at the end, but it's something around, what can we rely on in uncertain times? Perhaps not the most poetic, but there you go. Thank you very much for inviting me to your region. I feel duly honoured, and it's given me an opportunity to clarify many, many, many thoughts and to try and contain it into a reasonable amount of time. So thank you for that opportunity. I'm going to be talking about five main areas. Something around appreciation feels very important and apposite. Something around evaluation and critique, the phase we find ourselves in, perhaps. I'd like to talk on the subject of insight and our attitudes to that. I'd like to talk on the official and unofficial versions of the order, and also the public and private. And then finish with something on looking ahead. So that's the plan. And what I'd like to do is weave in the four reliances, the teaching of the four reliances from the Inconceivable Emancipation series, Sangharakshita's talks, and obviously from the Vimalakirti Nadesha. And this is the order at middle age, and I have my large print version. Okay. So the four reliances, we'll come back to this, but the first one is to rely on the meaning of the teaching, not on the literal words or the expression. To rely on the meaning, not on just on the words. Secondly, to rely, this is a bodhisattva, is exhorted to rely on the teaching and not on the person who teaches it. Relying on the teaching, not on the person who's teaching it. Thirdly, Bodhisattva is exhorted to rely on gnosis, transcendental awareness, or that's a translation of jnana, which is undivided awareness. So not on ordinary consciousness, vijnana, divided dualistic thinking. So relying on jnana, not vijnana. And fourthly, to rely on discourses of definitive meaning and not on discourses of interpretable meaning. So here we go. So I was 6 years old in 1967, and I came along to the FWBO, as it was, in when I was 21-ish, I think, 21, 22, about 1982. So I am somebody who has lived my whole adult life within this context and very fully. And I am who I am because of the FWBO, because of Tri Ratna, because of Sangharakshita, because of this whole thing. This is formed and informed my whole life. And just looking around, I just hear this is not my normal region, but there's an incredible range of connections that I have. Some people going way back to Brighton in the early days, or back to Croydon, or more recently on Facebook, or whatever it is. And it seems to me as I go on that what we have here with our network is something quite unusual in this day and age, perhaps in any day and age, I don't know. Facebook is an interesting one, I'll come back to that, but I've heard quite a few conversations of people, non-Buddhist friends saying, oh, Facebook, it's so inane. People going on about, what a waste of time. And I'm thinking, I have fantastic conversations on Facebook, really you know, really going there with the, you know, the Dharma and what do we understand by this and where are we going in Tri Ratna? And, you know, I sort of feel I just have this incredibly rich life, and the qualities such as I have, I feel, I mean, how would I know? I don't know what it would look like if I hadn't been part of this, but I can see that such qualities that I have that are appreciated by other people, well, they largely come from this context. So I rejoice, I rejoice. And so I just want to mention something from my early days, very early days. This actually, I realised, is basically the sum total of my shopping around experiences, which is I went to Chithurst Monastery when I was very new to Buddhism. The people I went with didn't, so it's a Thai forest monastic community. The people I went with didn't really explain anything about the Vinaya or what to expect. So I just turned up and I just participated like a sort of normal person. And it was quite a strange experience because there were all these, there was a particular culture which came from traditional Buddhist Thai culture, and I did all sorts of things wrong during the day. I later found out I asked a monk if he wanted a cup of tea and I handed it to him directly, and I thought it's a bit of a weird response. Why was he like that? And I went for a walk with an Anagarika down to the, a male Anagarika down to the lake, and that was very bad. I later found, and I served the, I don't think they were nuns at that point. I think they were Anagarikas, but anyway, the female monastics. I served them first, purely because they were first as we went round. But that was a no-no. And when I got to the abbot, who was Ajahn Sumedho, very well-known, fabulous Buddhist teacher, he gave me this sort of knowing smile. And I think he thought I was making a point, but I had no idea what his knowing smile was referring to. On the way home, I learned that I had totally put my foot in it. As you know, I was in my early 20s. Think back to one's youth and how social embarrassment, how cringy it can be. And I never went back because I felt so embarrassed. I felt angry with the people who I went with because they didn't tell me anything about it. I just felt I'd gone and put my big foot in it. I'd made a total fool of myself, and I never went back. And the sad thing is, in the middle of all that was the most fabulous Dharma talk, Ajahn Sumedho, absolutely at his best. And I knew at that time this was the real deal. You know, it was insightful, it was witty, it was kind of darkly humorous, it was just everything you want in a Dharma talk. And but it was in this context where that was not accessible to me personally at that point in my life. I wasn't able to make that translation. So when I came along to the Brighton Buddhist Centre, Sangharakshita, the translator of the Dharma, that's one of his main myths, it was a big yes. Of course we want to find, you know, we want to bring the essentials of Buddhism without importing all the cultural trappings. I totally got it. And the rest is history. So Bhante, there was a really big vision. And I wonder if this was inspired by experiences in India with the Ambedkar movement, something about something spreading very widely, very rapidly. It was quite a different model to something like Chithurst, which was quite a relatively small community. So, you know, there's this big vision without which there wouldn't have been a Brighton Buddhist Centre for me to walk through the doors of, or a whatever, fill in whichever one. We wouldn't be here, would we, without, most of us probably, without that big vision. And let's really celebrate ourselves as well as Bhante, the founder of this, because it wasn't just him, was it? It was all of us. And Let's just take a moment to celebrate the blood, sweat, tears, the joy, the misery, the sorting out difficulties, the inspiration, the hard work. I mean, just those of us in this room now. Just really get a sense of that, that the amount of energy and effort and love that has gone into this thing that we're part of. I'd like to rejoice. So we're at a period of evaluation, are we not? And this is very natural. Sangharakshita is 92. We don't know how long he's going to be with us. It's a big time of change. And perhaps it's more insecure because we're not part of one of those traditions in the way that, you know, the Thai forest monks are. We're different, aren't we? So we're kind of going through this evaluation, this critique. We're wondering who we are, what we can unite around, how we can go forwards, and how to make the next stage, how to really make the best of what we've been given and what we've come to so far. And I just want to make the point that there's a whole range, there's a huge diversity in the order, there's a huge diversity of views, as we know. There's all sorts of conversations and disagreements at times and critiquing and celebrating and so on. Let's just come back to the fact that we all want the same thing. We all want an order and a movement that is spiritually vibrant, that works for us, that works for our friends, that works for people who come along. We might have really different ideas of how to get there or what that looks like. So we're having this great conversation. And personally, I think this is fantastic. The need for a critique is an essential aspect of Buddhism. And I think that's one of the things that always attracted me about it. It's like, yeah, you're not given this thing. This is, here it is. This is what you believe if you want to be part of this. Critique is an essential part of the way we evolve and develop. And Sangharakshita is very clear on this. There's a lecture which you probably all come across, the Transcendental Critique of the Dharma. So it's only by means of critique that we can ensure that the means to the development of the individual remains a means and doesn't harden into an end in itself. So critique is vital to the health of the community, the Dharma teaching, you know, the sort of the clarity of the three jewels. So, and I think Sangharakshita has reminded us of that, where he says, Triratna sometimes bears the mark, not of the Dharma, but my own particular personality. My sense is that he is acknowledging that there is a need for an evaluation, a re-evaluation. And I'd like to say a bit more about that. But firstly, just that big vision and that rapid expansion in the early days. There's been quite a bit of talk of the shadow sides of things, hasn't there, recently? I think that's very healthy. And, you know, things generally do have a light and a shadow side, both literally and metaphorically. So I've been thinking about, well, what was the shadow side of the big vision and the rapid expansion, all those Buddhist centres popping up all over the, you know, major cities in the UK and elsewhere in the world? So one of them was back in the early days, no offence intended to anyone, but the quality of a lot of the teaching in our centres, I think, was pretty poor, especially meditation teaching. you know, if I think of my experience at Chidhurst, where I was sat in a room with somebody, I just thought, this person really knows his stuff. And then back at the Buddhist Centre in Brighton, where there were people who were my age, who'd just been ordained. People got ordained, men particularly, got ordained very quickly in those days. Yeah, they were almost my peers. And there was a sense, we're not even going to attempt, really, to come from our own experience here. There's an acknowledgement, well, we're quite inexperienced. We're not in a position to do that. Fair enough. And so Bhante was, he was the authority on everything, you know. He was, you know, he was this incredible, well-read, cultured person, quite exotic in his way, you know, all this experience in Kalimpong and so on. Many of us were like a generation younger than him as well. And think about what it was like then. Things have changed so much in 49, 50 years. So there was no internet at that time. No internet. No access to Insight, no Wikipedia, no insert your favourite site when you want to look something up. I give a Dharma talk now, as I expect most people do. I just Google it and pop. That didn't exist. There weren't even that many Buddhist books. There was like a, you know, there was a particular shelf full that we all had and we'd all read pretty much. You know, there were translations. Some of them were a bit King James Bible. You know, they were not the easiest things to wade through. So very different times. And I think we completely relied on Sangharakshita to do that translation for us. He was the authority. He was the authority on Buddhism, on culture, on lifestyle, on relationships, on everything. I mean, I'll speak for myself, you know. I don't know what was going on with other people. I'm sure some of that resonates with other people, but I don't want to assume, you know. I know we've all had different experiences as well. But I would certainly, from my memory, I would term this as the age as Bhante says. Bhante says da-da-da-da, so that's the truth. And so here we, you know, we're coming back to the reliances one and two. So relying on the meaning of the teaching, not on the literal words. Well, I think there was a huge reliance on the literal words. Simply repeating intellectually understood things, hopefully intellectually understood, never mind experientially understood, repeating the words and seeing that as, well, it needed to be like that. But also perhaps getting into a view that that was the Dharma, that was it. And relying on, you know, we weren't, perhaps, arguably, we weren't relying on the teaching, not on the person teaching it. We were, to quite a large extent, it was the other way around at that time. So I think the third bit of this shadow side of the big expansion was to do with, it's to do with a sense that of teachings being passed on a sort of intellectual, conceptual level, and perhaps a subtle view that's it. That's what the Dharma is. This kind of, well, I've heard what Bhante says, I remember, I've read it in this thing, or I heard it in that lecture, this is the... Do you see what I mean? Passing something on that level, but not so much from one's own lived experience, one's own actual realisation. So I wonder if we're still a little bit in that era, even though now we have so much, huge amount of experience and lived practice. I wonder if, you know, I wonder if we're still a little bit within that phase. Okay, so that's a little bit, that was to do with the big expansion, perhaps the shadow sides of that. So not such good quality teaching, meditation teaching. I spent decades trying to sort out some of the wrong views that I picked up in the early 80s. Trying very hard, harder and harder to get somewhere. A sort of unbalanced the developmental model without other things to balance it. And I wish someone had told me about discrepancy monitoring at that time, which is where, you know, you're trying to get somewhere, you're trying to think your way to somewhere, but it's something that can't actually be done in that way because it actually requires just relaxing back and so on. So the harder you try, the worse it gets. Spiral of, I'm rubbish at this, I'm rubbish, da-da-da-da. And, I'm making light of it, but I feel I experienced a lot of suffering, as I'm sure many other people did, and I don't blame anyone, but that's what happened. Thankfully, I think we've kind of left, to a large extent, we've left those days behind. Okay, so there's one more thing I'd like to talk about on the subject of re-evaluation. And this is the knotty subject of gender attitudes, gender issues within our order, within our movement. Okay, I'm just going to do this very straightforwardly. I'm not going to get really caught up. Someone give me a wave if it's late. Yeah, you're getting caught up. Okay, so there was recently a statement from the Adisthana Kula, which I welcomed, to do with I'm quoting from memory, but that the teaching that men are spiritually superior to women plays no part in our teaching now, something like that. So, but the truth is, our Mitra study course, I mean, there's lots of materials, as I'm sure we all know, within our body of teaching that do express some views about the spiritual capacities or relative lack of women. The handicap, the disability, those sort of words, okay? And in our current Mitra study course, there are actually 7 pages of this kind of discussion in the Transforming Self and World unit. I'm not going to do that with my Mitra group. My fabulous, wonderful Mitra group, who are raising their daughters and their sons to be confident, to feel that they can get out there and they can do as much as anyone else. I'm not going to go there. I feel embarrassed by it. And that's a shame because the Sutra of Golden Light has much to offer. But I feel that this business of translation, it doesn't just happen once. It didn't just happen 50 years ago. It's ongoing. We've got to keep this going. And, you know, if in the Sutra of Golden Light they say, may all women become men, well, let's look at that. We're looking at something from ancient India, from a long time ago, from another culture with different attitudes. Are we importing cultural attitudes that have no relevance and no place in our contemporary situation? You know, you look at what was available, the sort of choices that would have been available to women at that time. Well, no wonder they were saying, may they be reborn as men. You know, it wasn't a very equitable situation. But we don't need to recreate that. Now, I'm sure there's a whole range of views, and I just want to say, you're really entitled to have your views on this. I'm fine with that. I'm not telling you what to think. However, I'd like to make 3 points about this. So when I read through the Transforming Self and World, those 7 pages, I was quite surprised, staggered even, to find that the whole discourse seemed to be about nature and that there was no mention of nurture in there. No mention of the powerful effect of gender conditioning, the way we are brought up to believe certain things, to be certain things. We've all been through it. We all know what a strong thing that is. That's the nurture aspect. And Bante focuses on the nature aspect, which makes it immovable. You know, I was born a woman. I can't do anything about that. And this stuff, the idea was that if you do have a disability or a whatever the other word was, it's useful to take that on board and then you work with that. I'm sorry, that just wasn't my experience. I just experienced this as a sort of put down. Almost the image that comes is just of being kicked. I didn't find this helpful. I mean, I already had loads of self-doubt and low self-esteem and all that sort of thing. It just added another layer onto a sense of difficulty. And sadly, I believed it. And I was in that era of Bante says. He was the authority. He was saying it. It must be right. So although I argued and so on, I did take these views on. And 30-something years on, actually, I was doing some insight inquiry a few years back, and it all came up. Oh, I can't do this because I'm female. I'm spiritually disadvantaged. I'll never get this. So that was quite shocking. You know, that was something that reinforced the opposite of faith. Another thing that really struck me was there is no mention in those 7 pages of the potential problems associated with male biological conditioning. Really? I mean, should we just look at what's been going on here? That's very skewed. And this critique that, you know, it was the worst side of women being compared to the best side of men, I think there's a lot of truth in that. So perhaps there is something of the mark of a particular personality there. I don't know. I'll throw that out. However, the most important point, and this is far more important than any of the other things I've said so far on this issue. So this is within this 7 pages. So this is the pith, right? Ananda asks the Buddha directly, are women capable of the highest spiritual attainment? And the Buddha says, yes. So this is Bante's words. This, so far as Buddhist tradition is concerned, settled the matter once and for all. No one has ever suggested that the Buddha might not have said it. His words are absolutely categorical, and all other texts have to be interpreted in their light. This is the basic Buddhist principle, and it is underlined by other Pali Canon texts in which the Buddha emphasizes women's capacity to gain enlightenment. So here we have the fourth reliance, where we rely on the teachings that are definitive in meaning, not on the ones that are interpretable in meaning. So I would like to suggest that we take on that fundamental basic fact that there is nothing here that says that women cannot experience the highest spiritual attainment, and that all the other stuff, okay, you know, you've got your own experience, but that's open to discussion. But this is the definitive teaching. And perhaps we could, you know, perhaps we could use this. These four reliances are giving us a tool for evaluation and critique. Let's use it. Okay, bit more celebration. So I want to celebrate what I feel is an explosion of insight into the order. We're talking about insight. And yeah, that can be quite clunky. There's all sorts of views in there, but that's great. We've taken the lid off something, and surely this is, as Buddhists, this is what we're about. I have heard a couple of views to the effect that, you know, focusing too much on insight experience is selfish, or that it's in opposition to the Bodhisattva ideal. I suggest anyone who's expressing those views go and read the Diamond Sutra, the Sutta of Vimalakirti Nidesha, or frankly any other Buddhist scripture out there. And I think the answer is very, very clear, that compassion without wisdom isn't the full deal. They come together. There is with increasing direct seeing of reality, there is a decreasing sense of self, separation, boundary, and so on. And that's how it works. That's what it is. There's discussion about what it might look like. You know, does somebody have to be, you know, an all singing, all dancing, totally integrated, very nice person to have insight experience? Can you have insight experience and still act like a jerk? Is one of the things that came to me when I was writing this. I'll just leave that for you to answer. or to think about or discuss. Another thing that I think I've picked up on is an area of prejudice, expectation. Now, I know I've had this sort of thing. I talked about the women's stuff. I've had a view that I recognised at a certain point that only special people have insight experiences. And I didn't think I was a special person, and I was female, so that made it all the less likely, and so on. So we may have some prejudices about what we expect it might look like, and people who might have real insight experience, but there might be somebody that we don't particularly like, or there might be someone who some of whose views we don't like or even find abhorrent, perhaps in extreme examples. We might have gender prejudice. You know, we might seriously think, oh, it's a talk by a woman, I don't think I'll go to that. Probably not going to be very good. Prejudice is an unconscious thing. I'm currently doing a counselling training and we have to look at this stuff. And I tell you, it's fascinating. I've been working with awareness for all these decades, scratch the surface, and yeah, there's prejudice there, there's bias there. It's how humans, it's how our minds work. It's there. It may be to do with education, to do with background, it might be to do with nationality or race. You know, we know the field, don't we? Prejudice happens. It happened in the Buddha's day. So Bharadvaja, who was a young, precocious young Brahmin, receives this fabulous teaching from the Buddha. And in the end, he says, "We used to think these bald-headed contemplatives, these menial, dark offspring of the kinsman's feet... Who are they to know the Dharma?" So, you know, Brahmins, the Buddha wasn't part of that caste. Well, he's not going to know anything. And then he's really astonished because, of course, it doesn't fit his preconceptions. And that's not just Brahmins, that's everybody. We all have preconceptions. And if you go away with one thing from this talk, I would ask you to look at that. Really look at that. And there's a request that we do something called bias training as order members. Now, I've never heard of that before, but it sounds good to me. I think there is something in here. So when we come to the subject of insight, we're coming into the third reliance, relying on jnana, not on vijnana. So relying on direct, undivided awareness, not relying on the conceptual divided the vijnana. I'd like to just go back to that earlier point I made about the way our teachings have been passed on, and that I think we have relied to a very large extent on vijnana, on dualistic thinking. We would do. That's where we come from. But that's not what's being suggested in the Vimalakirti Nidesha. It's very clear. And I think to bring in another figure, another story, Huineng, which also, by the way, connects with the prejudice thing. Huineng was a menial worker, illiterate, working in the kitchen in this Chinese monastery, wherever it was. The fifth patriarch, it was time to pass the baton on to the next generation, and he asked for a verse to be that people who were aspiring patriarchs, I suppose, to compose a verse to show their understanding of the Dharma. So Shen Xu, I think that's how you say it, who was the head monk of the monastery, and I'm guessing a very cultured, educated person, quite high status within the community, well, the highest status, I guess, other than the abbot. So he came up with the verse, "The body is a Bodhi tree, the mind a standing mirror bright, and at all times polish it diligently and let no dust alight." So he's expressing a certain approach to practice, and you're probably all familiar with the story. Huineng, somebody reads the verse to him because he can't read, and he's like, that's not really it. And he comes up with his own verse, which he asks to be written up. "Bodhi has no tree, nor is there a stand for the mirror. Originally, there is not a single thing. So where can dust gather?" This is jnana. This is the voice of jnana. This is absolute, the absolute, whatever we want to call it. All the words are a bit, they're never quite right, are they? And of course, Huineng has to flee in fear of his life because it's not particularly appreciated that a low menial worker from the kitchen show greater understanding than the head monk. So yes, relying on jnana, not vijnana. So just on a personal note, I wrote something recently on our order sharing pages, and I found myself writing that although they had worked for me in so many ways in terms of integration, positive emotion, positive context, that the Triratna body of practices hadn't actually worked for me personally in terms of insight. And that felt like a very strong thing to say, but I speak my truth. That was my experience. So, but since then, I've been thinking about that. I'm thinking, no, that's not quite it, actually. And this is where the official and unofficial version comes in. It was like, actually, the practices that I needed and the people I needed to meet have all come to me through the order. Every one of them. Through the connections I have with you guys and beyond. And whatever I needed has come into my lap. It's just that it didn't necessarily fit with the official version, which I realised I could just let go of that. And, what am I gonna take my stand on? My own lived experience or a kind of idea of a sort of theoretical understanding. and it has to be the former. So I mentioned earlier about the difficulty that I personally had with this sort of one-sided developmental teaching, and this whole thing of trying to get somewhere that wasn't—it's not here; it's somewhere else, and it may be lots of lifetimes away, and all sorts of views in there. And then along came pure awareness. Balm. I mean, I so needed those teachings. I went on those, you know, I went on retreats at the time, which were very controversial. There was a lot of argy-bargy going on and people trying to get it stopped in some cases. And it was just like, I need this. This is, you know, this is bringing, it was rebalancing something for me anyway. And then later along came direct pointing, which for me has been life-changing, and this whole thing of, I think the core teaching is it's coming back to direct experience. It's peeling back all the layers of conceptualization further and further and just coming back to what's right here, what's actually happening now. Not in thought, or not in my idea, or my theory, or my explanation, but in that completely direct sense. And this is the teaching that just gives and gives and gives. So for me, currently I'm exploring inquiry into the 10 fetters, and it's sort of continuation. Again, it's quite contentious, there's lots of different views. So this is the order that I'm part of. This is my experience of the order. And who's to say which is the real order or the right order? Or this is me, this is my spiritual life. And so I just sort of came to this thing of the official and the unofficial versions of the order and the movement. It occurred to me that there's a bit of a parallel with private and public conversations. Now, I can think way back, I could have very, very open private conversations with friends in the order, in the movement. You know, the lid was off. We could talk about pretty well anything. But we didn't do that in more public situations. We just did that one-to-one and, you know, be like, well, maybe some of the gender stuff or maybe some of the teachings we weren't quite sure about. That was all, it was all open. But then there was a different culture for public conversations. And there were a lot of things that weren't said or were rarely said in those situations, or were only said a little bit, but not very much. Now, I wonder if the private and the public worlds are converging to some extent. And I would say that if this is indeed happening, probably it's got something to do with the internet. The internet, another thing I would like to celebrate, it's got a dark shadow side, to be sure, but it's a tool, and a tool is as good as the people who, you know, the intention of the people who are using it. And I think we need to learn to use the internet skillfully. You know, perhaps it's certainly a new thing for me a few years ago to be on Facebook and so on. But incredible opportunities. So, for example, mentoring, to have bits of contact with somebody every day who's looked at the thing you want to look at. They can give you little pointers, you go away, you see, well, what's my experience of this, you report back. It's not getting insight off the internet. We do the work, but there's somebody there to be a bit of a guide, to give some pointers and so on, you know, and you may be way off. Skype chapters, Facebook, there are people in this room who I feel I've really made friends with through Facebook. You know, it's a fabulous opportunity, and it's not going to go away. So I think anything that, oh no, we shouldn't do that, which I have heard those views, it's not going to work. You know, certainly not going to work for newer, you know, younger generations. And just coming back to this thing about the gender stuff, one of the this whole thing about biological women's biological conditioning was, you know, that we geared towards motherhood and so on. And of course, in our society, I don't know how it works in others, women who are at home with young children can be very isolated, cut off, lacking in opportunities to go on retreat or to go to classes or whatever. And yeah, I mean, I'm not stupid. I wouldn't argue with that. It's clearly the case. Now we have the internet. There's a bit of a different situation there. And actually, women in those situations, or indeed men, have all sorts of opportunities to be connected with spiritual friends for Kalyana Mitrata. You know, they can be in Skype chapters, or they can be mentored in with their meditation practice, or direct pointing, or whatever else. So this is another situation where, well, let's look at our culture now. Let's look at the situation we're in now, and it's not even the same as 50 years ago. Never mind ancient India, you know, umpteen centuries ago. So, last bit of my talk is to do with looking ahead. And I just want to say a few things. This is quite personal, what I would like to see. I would really love to see decision-making and leadership structures that allow maximum creative participation from the incredible diversity that is our order and movement. So we get away from the situation which just seems to repeat over and over again. It happens in centres. Perhaps it happens at times with the Preceptors College. You get one group of people who are a bit overwhelmed by responsibility. And then you get other people who feel a bit disempowered, and then they get annoyed, and then it all gets difficult. And I've just seen it. I've seen it in every single situation I've been in. This kind of dynamic. I've seen it in Butterfield, I've seen it at the Brighton Buddhist Centre, I've seen it writ large in the Order. And we just have to find some new structures that move us away from this kind of blocking each other. And again, I feel this is what everybody wants. You know, we all want this to be shared. We all want to be able to tap into the incredible creative potential that we are. But that needs structures, and this is not my area, but there are people who've got ideas about this, and I know there are things being trialled. For example, Amrigita has brought in a mandates system in Butterfield, and that is being trialled now as a way of spreading responsibility in a way that also maximises communication and connection. So I'm very interested in where we go with that. So connected with that, also an exhortation. Just when the time comes, especially as we're getting older, to be ready to step aside and to let other people step up. And I know from my own experience that once we're in a situation where, you know, I had it in Butterfield, actually. I got to a place where it was working quite nicely for me. I had quite a lot of power, in a way, and a certain amount of status. And it was kind of nice, you know. I'd sort of come to that from not having those things. And it's quite difficult to let go of, you know. It's like, oh, yeah, I can set this up so I can do the bit I'm interested in, and then I'll get someone else to do those bits. And you know, it's a very attractive position to be in, and we can have this situation where, you know, the fingers have to be kind of prized off, you know, this, yeah, I see a few smiles of recognition there. And I've been involved in a couple of situations where, for everybody's benefit, we were trying to prize somebody's fingers off. And I've been on both sides of this. The identification, the level of identification with a role or something, we feel that we've got the experience, maybe we don't trust that other people can do it. I mean, you know, they may make a bit of a hash of it to begin with, but, you know, that hasn't stopped us. Let's think about the early days. We wouldn't be here. It's going to be a bit messy, but, yeah, pass it on. Be willing to relinquish power and status. I mean, that sounds very strong. I don't maybe mean that how it sounds, but these are realities for human beings. Ask any anthropologist. You know, we do care about these things. We like to have control. But it doesn't always help the community or ourselves. I think it's great that we're naming some of these dynamics. It's uncomfortable. You know, did we come here to be comfortable or did we come here for the Dharma? You know, maybe we're in a spiritual death phase. Being uncomfortable is no bad thing. It's part of what we're signed up to. So there's a guy called Greg Kramer who's developed something called Insight Dialogue, which I did a bit on a retreat with Viveka a couple of years ago. And there's this thing about trust emergence. You don't plan what you're going to say. You don't have it all sorted out beforehand. And the quote, which I love this, stay close to what's unfolding. Ride the edge of impermanence. And that's what I want us to do. We're amazing. We are this amazing community. Let's trust that. We don't need to come from fear. And I feel there's a lot of anxiety around about what happens when Bhante dies, how are we going to, you know, what's going to keep us together, what if the whole thing falls apart? Okay, fair enough. But it's not going to help us if we act from fear. You know, this is basic Dharma theory we do in our beginners classes. You know, actions have consequences depending on the state of mind in which they're performed. If we act from fear, we are likely to create the very situation that we are frightened of. So let's come from confidence in our Dharma practice and not from fear. You know, let's come from those four reliances and not trying to hang on to structures as ends in themselves. And, yeah, let's not make Triratna an end in itself. You know, read Bhante on the Transcendental Critique of Religion. Brilliant. That's what, you know, I think that's very relevant now. So we never lose sight of this, the real possibility of awakening for all of us. We don't have to buy into an idea that it's so many lifetimes away or whatever. This is what we're here for. We're here for enlightenment, awakening. Awakening to the truth, to the reality. And this is available to us. If we think that this is not available to me personally, we haven't understood the Dharma. That's the whole point. That's the whole thing the Buddha was saying. This experience, that what he's experiencing, is possible for everyone. Now, if we don't believe that, then, well, no, it's probably not going to happen. Self-fulfilling prophecy. And lastly, I would like to suggest that we stand on Bhante's shoulders, that we really take the baton You know, this incredible life and work, everything that the movement is, and right, where's my quote? Here is Sangharakshita. So this is from the seminar on the heartfelt advice to Rachumpa. If in each generation the disciples fall below the level of attainment of the guru, in a few generations, what's going to be the state of affairs? So a guru should consider that he has not been successful as a guru until his disciples do better than himself. Otherwise, the chances are that the whole tradition will degenerate very quickly. So that's not rocket science, is it, to see the truth of that? I want to ask us to celebrate this incredible thing thus far and to take the baton and not to be restricted. Sangharakshita himself, it's like he's waving at us. He's saying, I'm a person. I've got my biases and so on. Don't get so stuck on this. You know, it's over to you. He's going to die. It's over to us. If it isn't an Aryan Sangha with real insight, it will die. So this means us. And we're quite capable of taking that baton. I have no doubt whatever about that. If we want to, and if we believe that we can, if we have faith. So I don't really identify as one of the sort of faith-following types, but actually I feel I have huge faith. I have faith in the possibility of awakening, that it's real, and it's not somewhere else. It's available. There's something that is available. This whole teaching is leading us to. And if we if we need to find something to group ourselves around, it has to be informed by that very explicitly, not like a theoretical structure that is purely on a kind of conceptual level. I'm not sure what's happening with the direction of the order and a sense of sort of wanting to systematize things. Personally, I really love the earlier version of Panti, the sort of more iconoclastic, a bit anarchistic. I'm not sure about this whole systemizing process, actually. But anyway, that's just me. Right, I must wrap it up. So, talked about, so quite a lot on the subject of appreciation of all of us and of course of Bhante, without whom we wouldn't be here, and none of those other things. I used to have conversations in Butterfield where people didn't realise that Butterfield came from the order and Sangharakshita, and they'd be a bit like, oh no, who's that guy, I don't really relate to him, but it, no. This is where this comes from, you know. So we need to honour that, but also not be stuck 50 years ago. We're now, future generations going on. So appreciation, critique, very important. I think one of the most fantastic and exciting things about the Dharma. I love it. Anyway, insight, being open to insight. Let's be open to insight experience, whoever it is. What if it's Mitras? Fantastic. You know, what if we're not sure? Maybe they've got into some dodgy view of, you know, they think they're somewhere where they're not. Well, talk to them. But, I mean, this sort of idea that, it's not good Mitras doing this insight work because how will it then work with the ordination process, or how will it then work at centres, which I have actually heard these views expressed this year. That's the wrong way around. That's making it into a means. That's making something that should be a means into an end. It's trying to shove people into our structures. Our structures are there to support our spiritual life, and that's That's what they're about. Okay, official and unofficial versions of the Order and Movement, and a little bit about looking ahead. So that's it. Thank you very much for listening.